I'm Jane Hart. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Jane.
And through the Care, Protection, Guidance of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have been sober since May 1st of 1981, and for that I am very grateful. I just want to thank the committee for inviting me. It's been an experience in which we will all truly remember. And one of the things that brings really up front for me and the experience of this conference is that we are but a small part of a great whole, you know, and as long as I remember that, everything will be fine. For those of you who missed the Alateen and Al-Anon speaker, you missed it. You missed it big time. And it was a real privilege to be able to meet Frieda, and both the speakers gave a really nice talk, and I am glad that I have been taught that I'm to at least stay in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, that it doesn't happen in the hallway. And that when I was new in sobriety, they said that my very life depended upon my giving to others. And when I was new, I didn't feel like I had anything to give. But what the old timers told me that what I could give was my presence. And that is something that has held me in good stead for 12 and a half years, that I'm at least willing to show up, and my presence means something. And the little gestures, like I'm reaching out my hand and smiles mean something. You know, some laughter, the Alateen gave us laughter. I mean, it was great. And in any way that I can do that, I am serving a purpose. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I did not have any purpose. And when they told me that my purpose is to be a maximum service to God and those people about me, that was a spiritual experience for me because I was purposeless. I didn't feel like I served any good goddamn purpose at all. And it meant something to me. So I try to do that I did in the beginning. Alcoholics Anonymous for me, as I understood it, is making use of the experience of the people who have come before me. And I am so grateful that I have been given a family of sponsorship that with a lot of people who have come before me, because I learn a lot, and I want to continue to learn. And you know, what is the point? And the point for me is that I'm at least willing to grow to the point until I get the point. Because there are things that my sponsors ask me to do. She asked, when I asked my sponsor, to be my sponsor, she wanted me to do five things. And she wanted me to read the third step out of the 12 by 12 for 30 days. She wanted me to write a long letter about myself. She wanted me to get to three, preferably four meetings a week, and one of those was to be a speaker meeting, because I had only listened to myself for so damn long, I needed to start listening to somebody else for a change. I was supposed to start sponsoring. I had stopped sponsoring. This was like 6 years sober. I got really dry. I got crispy critter, bone dry. AA needed me more than I needed AA. That's how dry I was. And the last thing that she wanted me to do was that she wanted me to wear a skirt and heels and act like a goddamn lady. And I said, okay, let me see if I got you right here, because I'm kind of like that. And I'm writing it down. And I'm saying, okay, you want me to do this and this and this and this, and you want me to wear a skirt and heels and act like a goddamn lady. And she said, that's right. And I got off that phone and was like, well, where in the hell is that in the big book? That is not in the big book of alcoholics. It's obvious this person does not know who I am, you know, because I had become somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous and almost had lost my sobriety as a result. But what came to me is in that big book, it talks about, do not let spiritual terms stop us from honestly asking ourselves what they mean to us. And what that then said to me was, don't let anything my sponsor has to say to me or ask me to do stand in the way of my change, because that's what I needed to do. I needed to change big time. And I started drinking when I was 14 years old. It was out of my dad. My parents were social drinkers big time. I mean, he had a beer. We knew it was 20 minutes of supper time. That's it. My parents are not drinkers, but they had some downstairs. They stashed it downstairs. That's how social they were in their drinking. And I had gotten into it at 14. And I remember it. This is how I remember it. It was a big glass of vodka. And it was about 3 o'clock in the morning. I had a girlfriend over, and my dad said something over the stairwell. And I'm sitting there with this glass of vodka. And the fear of getting caught didn't stop me. The fear of getting caught never stopped me from doing nothing. And I downed that thing, and I liked the effect. I slept like a baby, and I absolutely loved the effect of alcohol. And it seems as if from that point on, I lived for the next time I could have that kind of effect. But I was 14, and Iowa was a 21-year-old state at that time. I'm from Cedar Falls, and it's a university town. And so I got into some other things before I could really readily get that. And left Iowa in a state of rebellion. I was 17 years old. Iowa was the problem. They're all a bunch of redneck farmers. My parents lived in the 40s. I was living in the late 60s. It was like, man, I needed to get out there and experience life. It was the sitar music. It was free love and peace and You know, I mean, it was incense and living off the floor. I mean, that's where that was the time period. And in order to really know yourself, you needed to go out there and experience. So I left Iowa with a big time resentment and went down to Southern California via Georgia. That's kind of how we do things, you know. And nothing's ever on the straight and narrow, you know. We kind of go like this. And to make a long story short, I ended up in the United States Army. But when I was in Southern California, I had started drinking at 14, and California was a 21-year-old state. And I was on the streets of Southern California with no home, and I found a job a week after I got there, and the hostess let me move in with her, and they were like 28, 30 years old. And they took me to a bar one night, and they let me have one drink, and I was a minor. And I had this one drink, and when I walked outside the bar door, it was like I was so pissed. And the reason I was that way was because I wanted another drink and couldn't get it. And it wasn't because I wanted to spend time with these people. It was because I wanted another drink. And that was at 18 years old. So it didn't take me very long, you know, to get to that point. And so I was in Southern California, and, you know, as noble as I can be, you know, my parents didn't want me out. I mean, I was a runaway teenager before we had movies about it, you know. And, I mean, I was a lot of things before I knew what I was, you know. And so I moved up to Sacramento because I had some uncles up there, and I partied for about a month with a cousin of mine. It was obvious that I wasn't into getting a job, and I was very much into a free ride, which is, I'm sure we all can relate to wanting to get a free ride. So the relatives were getting kind of upset that I was out for a free ride, and they wanted me to come back to Iowa, and I said, no way. If I was bad, I was going to be the best bad damn one that I could be, and there was no way I was going to come back to Iowa. So I was on the run, and I was rebelling, and I was angry. And so I joined the United States Army, having no idea what the Army was like. It was like, well, I just got to get the hell out of here. And that's what my drinking was a lot. I have to get the hell out of here. And so I joined the Army, having no idea what it was like. And they sent me back to the East Coast. And, of course, I couldn't get the booze during boot camp. But one of the things is I got along real well in the service because you give me a game plan, man, and I'll play it. I mean, don't turn your back on me. Don't think that I'm being honest about it, but I can play the game. And so I got along well in the service. And when I got to AIT at Fort Jackson, South Carolina, then the EM clubs were there. You know, the enlisted men clubs were there. So you have booze and men. I mean, a great combination. And it was at that time that I look back and see where I had really, really, most assuredly crossed an imaginary line to where there was no control of my drinking. It was at this time that the blackout started in. It was the daily drinking. And I would go back to the barracks and just pass out. And, you know, it's like we're unconscious a lot when we're drinking. And, I mean, we drink until the state of oblivion going. And I was one that went under wanting another drink. I went under wanting another drink. And it was like a Frito-Lay potato chip. I couldn't have just one. I mean, I had to have the whole bag, you know, and went under wanting more. That's how come I know that I'm an alcoholic, that I could never drink just one. I always wanted more. And I know that really, when I look back, that really was at that time. And so during this time, I met a man from the hills of Fajardo, Puerto Rico, and he didn't speak English. So you kind of know what our communication was, you know. And I said hi, and he said hola, and we got married. And I can remember it was that day that I was going to leave to ETS out to, or to go to permanent party in Fort Worth, California. It was the day I was to leave on my flight. And I walked in the mess hall, and this guy says, you're not leaving. And I said, oh, and the next thing I know, he was going to his company commander. I was going to mine. And we got married in some town. I don't even know who the witnesses were. But I remember when they pronounced us man and wife, and you may kiss the bride, and he kissed me, and I bawled. I bawled because I knew I had just made the biggest damn mistake in my life. But you don't admit that. You know, I was so rigid and so inflexible and had such an inability to admit that I was wrong. I made my bed, damn it, I'm going to lay in it. And he stayed there, and I went out to California, and we do what we do for that 2 month period. Hell, he wasn't there, so it's like I wasn't married. I mean, if it wasn't right here, it wasn't happening, you know. It's like I had no problem living the moment. When they talk about living one day at a time and living the moment, I had no problem with that. He wasn't there, I wasn't married, and that's exactly how I lived. And so he showed up and was like, oh yeah, I'm married. Well, this guy was a nut. He was a nut, you know. He was a nut. I didn't know him, and you know, and through a real, you know, violent marriage and everything, I had to leave, but I stayed long enough to get pregnant, you know, and it's like, hey, you know, I know the gals understand it never happens to us, but it does happen to us and happened to me, so, you know, here I was. By the time I was 20, 21 years old, I had been married, divorced, and had a baby in that order. And, you know, and the progression of the drinking only got worse. And I decided I didn't want to stay in the service for my child's sake because I can be so damn noble. And the great act of humility, I came back to Iowa so that I could be with my family and that she could have roots and all those things that we want to puke at when we're drinking. And I can remember that when I joined the service, my uncle gave me one of those simple talks about values and how he married his childhood sweetheart and how they have their little house and they have their little kids and they have their little car and it was like, well, who in the hell wanted it? I mean, he was acting like that was something to have, and my whole thing was to get out there, you know, to get out there and to experience it. Like, I didn't want to be barefoot and pregnant. It was the last thing I wanted. I never even dreamed about a white picket fence. I mean, I was not a little girl who grew up with dolls. I thought they were stupid. You know, I mean, who wants to play with a plastic thing? You know, I mean, I just wasn't. So, I mean, I was that way from the get-go. I know my mother was very disappointed in me because I didn't play with dishes and stuff. It's like, why? That's work, you know? I mean, so that was my attitude from the shoot. And I came back to Iowa. And I was on unemployment for about a year, and anything you do for the alcoholic, they're not going to do for themselves. And this was in 1976, and the disease had progressed to the point where I was working on a bottle of vodka one night, and I went to pull out the refrigerator door, and I kept it in the refrigerator so it would be cold, you know, and I had enough for one more drink, and I pulled it out of the refrigerator, and as I pulled the bottle out of the refrigerator, I fell to the floor and flapped around on the linoleum floor like a fish out of water. You know how fish just kind of flap around when they're out of water? That's what I did. And I was aware of it. I was aware that I had just done that. And what I did was I got up and I made that last drink. And normal drinkers don't do that. I mean, they just don't. They quit, you know, and I couldn't. And the deal was, and what carried way on into my sobriety, was the fact that that didn't happen. It never happened because nobody saw it. So it didn't happen. It did not happen. And that went way on to my sobriety, that as long as you people didn't know it, it didn't happen. And so they stress, you know, rigorous honesty. And it says in the fifth chapter that it's those people who can be honest with themselves about it. And I wasn't capable of that because it was still working. Even with seizures, it was still working. And so I had tried being a hostess in Southern California. You know, I tried to be a troop of the United States Army. I have now tried marriage. You know, I've tried divorce. You know, I have tried being a mother. You know, I have tried geographical escapes. You know, I have tried a lot of things in order to make my life better, but it wasn't getting any better. So that at this point, I thought, well, what I really need is to get intelligent. I need an education. If I could just think, you know, I can remember sitting out. I can remember getting a beer every 15 minutes. In the throne, you know, every alcoholic has a throne in their living room. That's where they sit, you know. And sitting in my throne in my living room, having a beer every 15 minutes, just wondering how come I couldn't think. And it was like it was beyond me to understand how come I just couldn't think. And so I went down to a community college in Ankeny, Iowa, and I quit drinking at this point because, you know, it was kind of sort of maybe perhaps possibly I just might have a small maybe drinking problem maybe if you stretched it. It was that kind of deal, you know. And so I did quit for 2 months at this time, and it was because I wanted to razzle and dazzle. I wanted to prove to my parents I could do this, and I wanted to prove a lot of things. So I did quit drinking for 2 months, and there was only one other time that I had quit drinking. That was during my pregnancy, and I see that as divine intervention because I did not make a conscious decision not to drink. And there was not an overwhelming maternal feeling towards being pregnant or this child. It was like you take care of business. When I went in to have my child, it was like I'm taking care of business. When the kid was born, I was going to take care of business for the next 18 years. And I just took my little uniform, put it on, and marched because I was just going to take care of business. And it was like, hell, she's fed, she's clothed, she's diapered. You know, what more do you want? You know, and at 14 months old, this kid couldn't walk. She couldn't, you know, because she had no stimulation. She may have had a clean diaper, but that was it. And that's you know, there is a family illness. It affects all of us. And so I went down to school, and I quit for 2 months, and I was taking law, pre-law. and got picked up for an OMVY. And, obviously I went back to drink, and I don't remember going back to the drink. I don't know where I was. I don't know who I was with. You know, you would think that that would be one of these red flashing lights, you know, and it wasn't. And I started, and I pulled some grade point average, and I'm like a quarter horse. You know, I can go the short distance, but don't ask me to go the long haul. I mean, that is me. It was me. And so I went back to the drinking and got picked up for an OMVY June 1st, 1979. And I was taking pre-law, and while I was driving, I had no idea why I was driving. It was at a local pub there in the neighborhood called the Zoom Zone. So you kind of know what kind of bar it was, the Zoom Zone. And I was staying with some guy in the backyard. It was the apartment complex in the backyard of this bar. Why we drove, I have no idea. Why I was driving, I have no idea. And Roger, who was the state trooper who arrested me, they watched me drive that car around that block three times. And I would go around, and I couldn't quite get it. And I'd go around, and I couldn't quite get that car in the driveway, so I'd go around the block again. About the third time around, Roger had to stop me. And so when I got out of the car, I thought, our alcoholic ego, you know, we can be in the gutter and look down on people. And I was probably the most cordial drunk they have ever picked up. And when I got out of the car, I gave him the charge. I gave Roger the charge. I said, OMVY, right, Roger? And Roger tried to get me to go through these drunk tests. And was like, no, Roger, I'm just too drunk. Just take me away. And so Roger took me away. And I got thrown in the Polk County Jail. And at 4 o'clock in the morning, my parents got a call and said, why I gave them my parents' name for the next of kin. I have no idea. I had to be drunk. And but the next morning when I got up, I wasn't so cordial. And I was belligerent, and I was arrogant, and I was angry, and I was obstinate, and I was all those things that can stand in the way even today sometimes. And I was yelling. They took my glasses away from me, and I cannot see anything without my glasses, and I'm yelling through those old bars how I have the right to see my accuser, you know. And, I mean, I was just obnoxious. But that put me into the system, and the probation officer gave me a stack of papers, and every 2 weeks, I already had like about a month filled out, you know, and just had them, so I just dropped them in the, and I got off, you know, I got 8 months I was off. But I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous during this time, and when I was going to school in Ankeny, I had met a gentleman who at one time had obviously been to Alcoholics Anonymous, and he took me to my first meeting. For that, I am very grateful. I am so grateful that that man took me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I am really grateful for that, that I was taken to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I went to the meeting, and it was like, I went to the meeting so I could keep telling the probation officer that I wasn't drinking and going to a meeting. I went to one meeting, of course, and that means we've always done it, you know. And I was much impressed with Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of the reasons why I was much impressed was the fact that, you know, I had lived in Southern California, I had lived in Sacramento, I had been to Atlanta, you know, I've been to New Orleans, I've been to a lot of large cities, and nobody knew my name. And it was not unusual for me to live in large complexes, apartment complexes. People never knew my name. Who cared? Who needed a phone? That was a luxury. I didn't want to talk to anybody anyway. Who wanted to talk to anybody? You know, I mean, why? There was no purpose in it, you know, in that spiritual bankruptcy, to where I could give a you-know-what. I could give a you-know-what. And so that when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, the fact that when I went into a meeting and I was welcomed and the hand was there and I came back the next week and those people knew my name, that meant a lot. That meant a lot. And I hope it's a lesson and that it's an action I still do today. I still welcome. I still hug, you know. I go out of my way to give a cup of coffee. We have no idea what that can do, not just for the newcomer, but for us who have been there for a while. It used to be that my life absolutely depended upon how I could rip you off. I best rip you off before you rip me off, and that was my motto, and that's what I did. And through the spiritual experience, through the miracle of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, my very life depends upon what I can give to you. And this may have been a small turnout, you know. There may have been a few who were active in this thing, But it is your privilege. It is your privilege to have done that. It is my privilege that I have had some experiences in Alcoholics Anonymous where I could give, because it is in that that I have learned. And so I was much impressed with Alcoholics Anonymous, but I wasn't done yet. AA came to me about 2 years before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a big difference. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous is for people who want it, not who need it. And I thought, I'm willing to admit that I have a drinking problem. But what I did then was I continued with other things, you know. And so I wasn't sober for 2 years. And I'd go to these meetings, and I'd read the book. I read the book because, God forbid, I wouldn't have something to talk about. God forbid. And I'd read that little daily reading every Tuesday night, and I'd go to that little farming community meeting, and there were older people in it. And I was 25 years old, because I was 27 when I sobered up. And I was just like a chatty Cathy. You pull my string, and I will give you the appropriate response. And my mother and father had taught me my manners. I knew how to, I flashed my smile. I respected my elders. And I sat in Alcoholics Anonymous for 2 years like that, bold-faced lying to these people. I took a year chip talking about how wonderful sobriety was. I was a month short of taking a two-year chip and something happened. And what happened was is that I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. And the spiritual awakening was the fact that I could no longer do that. And I had hit some kind of bottom to where I saw the truth. And the truth is a really hard thing for alcoholics to see. The truth is a really hard thing for us to see, especially when it's about us. I mean, I may know everything about your alcoholism and know absolutely nothing about mine because it involves me. And that's how come I need sponsorship, because I have a real hard time seeing the truth. But the truth hit. And this man that had brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was 13 steps into AA. And of course, you know, he wasn't all that was being presented. And I went to him and I said, this is what I want to do. I want to take a new sobriety date. I want to take a white chip in my home group. And he said, I wish you wouldn't do that. And the reason I share that is because I got sober for me. I didn't get sober. If it meant I lost that man, fine. If it meant that I lost the roof over my head, fine. If it meant that my kid and I had to live in my car one more time, fine. But I was done. So I went to these people, and I told them the truth. And any time I sat in a meeting before then, the closer it got to me, the more nervous I would get. And of course, it was because I was lying. You know, I was lying every time I went. And that night, something happened to me. And that the closer it got to me, the more excited I felt. And the more relief I felt. And it came to my turn, and I copped out. And you know, guys, nobody threw any stones. Not one of them. I sat there for 2 years, bull-faced lying to those people. And nobody threw any stones. They put their arms around me, and they said, it's wonderful having you. And I have been sober since May 1st of 1981, and that's been continuous sobriety. And that's by the grace of God, sponsorship, and Alcoholics Anonymous. And so that there were some things that AA had set an example for me that has held me in good stead for a long time. My sponsor, I said, oh, Peggy, I do not want that to happen to me. And she said, I don't either, Jane. And she said, that's why we're going to continue doing what we did when we first came in. And so I try and do that. I got a sponsor and worked through the steps as outlined in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous to the best of my ability at that time. And when I came home from that meeting that night, when I took my white chip, I had a spiritual experience. Before this time, I kind of felt like God was like, you know the fishbowl theory, where you have a fishbowl and you're watching the fish swim around, and you may kind of like watching them now and then you go off and do something, you come back, but you really don't have any. I mean, you can feed them and stuff, but you really don't. I mean, it's like a fishbowl, and that's what I thought God was. He just put us on this earth thing like a big fishbowl and just watched us. I didn't believe. I did not think that it was capable. I did not think I was capable to have an intimate personal relationship with God. And when I went and got my white chip that night, I came home, and the glory of it.
because it was that time, it was at that moment that I realized that it was more than me just being aware of God, that God was intimately aware of me, because I had gotten a strength and a power to do that that I could never have done before. And so, you know, that experience has held me in good stead. And I used to worry about, well, you know, I wish I could feel that again. Oh, boy, I sure wish I could feel that again. And one of the things that the old-timers told me is that this is a do-right, feel-right deal. It's not, if I waited, you know, guys, if I waited this, I mean, if I would have waited until I mean, that's still today, you know. If we would have all sat here and went on our feelings, where in the hell would we be? Just take this weekend. You know, it's a do-right. If I'm willing to go and do-right, the feelings will come. That's it. It's not a feel-right, do-right. It's not, well, when I get willing. It's like I put forth the action and that comes. Those feelings come after I put forth the action. And it's the action of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, my first step, the first four step I sat down, right, I smoked a joint so I could get real honest. That was the first one. And obviously that didn't work. But I wrote a four step sober, and I went and gave it to my sponsor, and we spent the day, and I gave her everything. And she died here not too long ago. But I fall so short of living up to her patience and her tolerance with the newcomer. And I told her everything. And when we got done, she called me a sweetheart. And I was like, how could that woman call this a sweetheart when we were done? But that taught me a forgiveness. You know, it is only through my willingness to give to you do I receive. That old saying where it goes, what goes around comes around. You know, if I want tolerance, I best give some. You know, if I want patience, I best give some. Those things that I want for myself, I best be giving away. What goes around comes around. And getting these feelings, it's like, well, did I feel any different? Well, who gives a shit? The fact is I took a fifth step. And shortly thereafter, I went home, and I looked, and it was as simple as this at the time. You know, I mean, I have grown in my understanding and my experience in the steps, but back then, all I knew in the sixth step was that I didn't want that anymore. My God, anything not to live like that anymore. And I went on to the seventh, and I got on my knees, and I took the seventh step prayer, and there was a presence of God. And I can remember, you know, when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, my fear immobilized me so much that I couldn't walk down the streets of Nevada, Iowa. This is a town of 5,000 people. But I couldn't walk, and there were stores I couldn't go into, Tipton Drugstore I couldn't go into. I couldn't go into the library. And after I took my seven-step prayer, I can remember I came home and I was absolutely thrilled because I walked into Tipton Drugstore. Now, that may not sound like much, but if that isn't the walking dead, if that isn't life as an endurance contest kind of life, I walked into Tipton Drugstore, and to me that was a spiritual awakening. It was that I could not do before. And it wasn't on this one. You know, sometimes I think with my sobriety I really don't need a drunkalog. I mean, you know, I mean, if life was to get just so wonderful, you know, I really sometimes I think that. I look back and I think with sobriety, who needs it? Because I've had a lot of things happen to me in sobriety. But so what? I mean, so what? Anyway, I went and made my amends to my parents, and they had disowned me at one time. And I asked them for the privilege to be able to come and meet them because they didn't have to. Those people did not have to. And I went and I made my amends, and we talked. And my father said, perhaps if I could have talked to you more when you were younger. And my mother said that she'd always loved me. And I made some, you know, it was always like, I always demanded that those people understand me. Not once did I ever stop to think perhaps I should understand them. Not once. You know, you were there to serve me. I wasn't there to serve you. You were there to serve me according to my demands and when. Not 5 minutes from now, but now. And, you know, I caused them a lot of heartache. There was many times my parents didn't know where I was at. And I have a daughter now where I don't know where she's at. So, I mean, that even gets, you understand that even more. And so... But I think that this disease is a hard thing for people to understand and a hard thing to accept. And some of the normal people think it's just a matter of control and you just don't drink anymore and then you get good. Well, I didn't get good. I'm still not good. I don't want to really be good because, I mean, it's really kind of boring, you know. I mean, it's like I want to have fun, you know, and I break bad every now and then. You know, it's not like I go down this road being good all the time. I break bad, and sometimes I want to break bad, you know. And so that it wasn't the fact that I was bad trying to get good. It was the fact that I was sick trying to get well. And that's where I'm still at. I mean, I'm still there. But my parents kind of thought that it was just being a bad girl, now she's going to be good. So that in the long haul, for 10 years, I made amends to my parents for 10 years. I wanted to be a part of them so bad. But I think, it seems to me, that my parents and I got together because I had a child. And they have been very good to that child. And I thank them from the bottom of my heart for that. But that, at this point, my family and I are estranged. But so what? That has absolutely nothing to do with my spiritual responsibility. I maintain contact. I send them cards. It doesn't matter. It has absolutely nothing to do with those people. It has everything to do with me. Absolutely everything. And my sponsor has given me some direction there that I do not understand. And I mean, it's really, you know, sometimes I get quite excitable and my voice kind of raises and I can, and it's like, God damn it, Peggy. You know, and it's like, I don't mean to be yelling at you, but I mean, really, you know. And she loves me enough to allow for that, and so I'm willing to go to the point until I get to the point, until I understand the point. I'm willing to grow to the point until I get the point. Because there's a lot of things I do that I don't get the point. But I have faith and I have trust with those people who came before me. I make light of their experience. And I want what my sponsor has. You know, I want what my sponsor has. And what my sponsor is an active member in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she'll have 30 years in February. And it's like, I want that. I want her vitality. I want her life. I want her sense of humor. I want her ability to love. I want her wisdom. You know, when we come in as newcomers, our world's just like this. You know, we grow a little bit, and I may get like this. And mine's probably about right here right now, and Peggy's is like that. And I want my world to be like that. And to me, it's through a spiritual deal. It's a spiritual deal. And so I believe in sponsorship, and I believe in having one sponsor. And I call my sponsor. There's some things I do in the program that I call at least I can do. And the least I can do is that I can get to at least 3 or 4 meetings a week. That's the least I can do. The least I can do is extend my hand to that newcomer and go to meetings consistently enough to know who is new. You know, I call my sponsor at 10:10 every Monday night without fail. You know, I sponsor. I love to sponsor. The women I sponsor, I love the women I sponsor. And I have created a family in Alcoholics Anonymous. My God, where would I be had that not been given to me? Where would I be? I don't think I'd be here. When I was 6 and 7 years sober, I was a dry, crispy critter. I mean, bone, arid, desert time. I mean, I had gotten so spiritually bankrupt at 6 and 7 years, that the only thing I had left to do was to pick up a drink. I was stealing from Paul to pay Peter. The boss, she was just damn lucky I was showing up every day. The kid, I'd started yelling at the kid again, and that had stopped. You know, I had stopped sponsoring. You know, I'd started taking groups inventories. I'd started taking states inventories in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was inventorying my way right out of AA. And I wasn't going to stick, guys. I wasn't going to stick. You know, when they talk about we lose a lot of people between 5 and 10 years, that's not cow doo-doo. That's true. And I know that from my own experience. Had God not placed certain people in my life and I was willing to listen, I wouldn't be here today. And I had to surrender in Alcoholics Anonymous as much, if not more, than when I let go of the drink. And You know, so that I try to do this thing I try to practice these principles in all my affairs. I had gotten married in there somewhere, and when I was 2 years sober, I had tried to save this marriage because I did love him. And so how I tried to save this marriage is that I got into Harley Davidson motorcycles. And how I looked was is that I had the shorty gloves with the fingers cut out. I had the three partition billfold with the chain in the back of my pocket. I had a butch haircut, a buzz, and I had the black goggles, and I had the Harley Davidson tank top that said genuine Harley Davidson parts. I had jeans on that didn't know what underwear was. I had boots that had been rained in and on them. And that's what I was at 2 years sobriety. And I went to a biker deal. And I had an XLX Harley Davidson Sportster, 510 pounds dry, shorty dual. Very nice, brand new when I got it. And we went to a biker thing. And there was women there. Now, I'm a prude, and it's taken me about 3 years to admit that, since my sponsor told me that. I thought I was prudent. That sounded better. It was easier to swallow. But I am really a prude, and which is why I always had to have a drink. I always had to have a drink. I always had to have a drink to do what I did. I mean, there were some things I valued, but after a while in drinking, they got to the point where I didn't value anything. And so we go to this biker thing, and I mean, there was women there. There were men there. There were couples there. I mean, there was a lot of people there with no clothes on. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, they don't have any clothes on. I mean, these people have no clothes on. I wasn't there 15 minutes before I was thinking, well, maybe I won't have any clothes on. You sit in a barber chair long enough, you're going to get a haircut. No purpose in being there. Absolutely none. Well, thank God, before I went down there, I had looked up in the directory of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I knew where there was a meeting. And so we went, and I stayed with those people the weekend. AA is everywhere if I reach out. It is my responsibility to reach out. That's mine to do. And anyway, this bond wasn't, I mean, you just can't really have a bond with Harley Davidson. I mean, you know, it's either there or it's not. And I decided that you know, it wasn't just that, it was a culmination of things, but I had to let that marriage go. And it was a very hard thing for me to do. It wasn't an easy thing for me to do, but I knew that I couldn't hang on to that and stay sober. And I want to be sober. And so I became an ice queen in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was ready to live the rest of my life absolutely celibate. Because, and I mean that in sincerity, because the price had gotten too high. How that affected me and my family, the price had gotten too high. So if that meant that I was not to have a relationship, so be it. So be it. But what happened was, is that I got totally self-sufficient. I mean, totally self, and took great pride, false pride, in being self-sufficient. And that's not what this deal is all about. I need you more than you need me. And but anyway, I was an ice queen. They're telling me I'm an ice queen, and I'm just an ice queen. And then I got my sponsor, and she made me wear heels and shit, you know, and do something with your hair, like curls or something, you know, and. It was like, oh, God. But what happened was that there was a man that I grew up in Alcoholics Anonymous with, and I sobered up May 1st of 81, and he sobered up May 3rd of 81. And he says he met me right then, and I say I met him about 3 years later because I was just too into self to know that he was there. And anyway, he would come, and we would have dinner once. We were friends, and Jim would stop in, and he knew my husband, and he was just friends, and we'd stop in, and we'd have, you know, I mean, it was nothing for Jim to stop in, and we were just friends, and when he went off and got married for like 3 months, you know, I mean, he went out and got his experience, and I got my experience, and he showed up like at 8 years, and I remember this because he was going to take me out to eat at a really nice place. Oh, he did. He was a very nice man, and my parents were there, and my 14-year-old kid was there, and he pulled up to my trailer, and I had this real need to say, this is not a date. And my daughter says to me, well, it sure looks like one to me. And so we go to this restaurant, and I see this woman in the program in the restaurant. I'm sitting there, I'm thinking,
Well, I wonder if she thinks this is a date. And this stuff started coming in, you know, and I'm talking and all this. And it's like, well, Jim's just, he's just separated. He doesn't have, what am I doing with this guy? He's not divorced. And all this stuff started in, so I told my sponsor about it. And she says, well, Jane, it sounds like your feelings towards him are changing. And it was like, you could have heard a pin drop. It was like, Jim Samuelson? No way. And, you know, I didn't tell a soul. I did not tell a soul. I didn't tell a soul. And 3 weeks later, we had to go to Marshalltown. Mutual friend was speaking. He lives in Cedar Rapids. I live in Ames. He wanted to drive me home, which was like an hour out of his way. And I said, Jim, you don't need to do that. But then it wasn't unlike Jim not to do that. I mean, it was a Jim kind of thing to do. And so I thought, okay, well, you can take me home if you want. He says, I need to talk to you, but it'll only take about 3 minutes. I said, well, that's fine. So we had a nice drive. We hit Nevada. It was three minutes before we got to my place. And he goes, you know, Jane, I have to tell you something. And that is that my feelings towards you are changing. I said, no shit. I just talked to my sponsor 3 weeks ago. And in God's timing on things. And we dated for 2 years, and we went slow. We were so slow. My sponsor called us lizards, that we were like little lizards down the desert, and we'd stick our head up and come back and wait. And we were prudes. I mean, we were really slow because we were scared. And it's like, I loved him, and I didn't want to screw it up one more time. I loved Jim, and he loved me, and we didn't want to screw it up. And we knew that this may just be a spiritual stepping stone. It may just be an opportunity to practice. You know, we didn't know, but we went real slow, and we dated. It was like we didn't know we were dating until we were dating. It was like, are we dating? I looked up in the dictionary. Screw it. I mean, I need to know what it is. I don't know what dating is. What's dating? I never dated. Did you guys date? I never dated. I went out and got drunk and went home with them. I never dated. You know, I didn't. And I, what was their name? I don't know, honey, babe, something. I never knew what their name was. And but I was dating, you know. And I was, you know. And we decided, you know, we wanted this thing to be sponsored. We wanted sponsorship in whatever we were doing. And we wanted the principles in whatever we were doing. And we went on a vacation out to the international, and we were just dating at the time, and it was nuts. It was nuts. It was like we went to the international, and then we had a little vacation afterwards, and I mean, it was beautiful vacation. It was wonderful. He rented a little Mercedes convertible, and we went around the mountains of Washington. I mean, it was just really nice, you know. But he was a nut. He was a nut, and he hadn't been sponsored for a while, so he was, I mean, just real flake, okay? And I can be a bitch. You know, I'm a bitch, and he's a flake. That's kind of what our deals, you know? And when I got back from there, we had been seeing each other for a year, and I didn't care if I ever saw that man again. It was like, I didn't care. But my sponsor said I had to date this guy for 2 years, and I had a year to go yet. If she'd given me 6 months, no sweat. If she'd given me a year, I would have took the bit in my teeth and done it. But she gave me two, and it took it completely out of my hands. So I had another year to go with this guy. And it was like, thank God, or I would have missed it. Now, there's been times when I have followed my sponsor's direction, regardless of what I thought about it, regardless of what I felt about it, regardless if I even knew what it was all about. You know, I have complete trust in those people who have come before me if they're good members and good standing of Alcoholics Anonymous. I trust Alcoholics Anonymous. I have faith in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so we got married, and it was wonderful. It was beautiful. It is beautiful, and we have our relationships based on the 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, which means that we have a group conscience. You know, nobody's boss. You know, we come to decisions together. We bought this refrigerator. I just want a cold box. That's all I want. Because I'm not a cooker, and I'm not Betty Crocker. You know, I'm just not. You know, I'm just not that way. You know, and Jim's a cooker, and you know, I mean, he likes gadgets and stuff, and humidity controls, and you know, and I just want a cold box. It's cheap, and so we go to Sears to get this thing, and we went to buy the cold box, but then the salesman showed us this really nice one, and it was a good deal. Well, see, the thing is that Jim had been reading Consumer Reports. See, he loves Consumer Reports. And so he knew all about refrigerators by the time we went. Well, he was the informed member of the group conscience, and I had to defer. And for me to defer is a spiritual experience, is a spiritual awakening, that whatever is in the best interest of the group, I must sacrifice. And that means my pride and my bossiness and wanting things my way. And, you know, I really like that refrigerator. Every time I open it, it's like, God, you know, this is really a nice refrigerator. You know, but that's how we do this thing. I'm treasurer, you know, but I'm the treasurer. We sit down, we have a group business meeting twice a month. You know, and then that's what we do. And we believe in the principles of consultation, which means that we go to our sponsors, you know, because we believe that a good informed group conscience is the best that you can have. And I moved to Cedar Rapids then, and I didn't want to move. I sobered up in Ames, and the deal was is that if Jim found a job in Des Moines, then we would be over there, and if my house sold first, then I would move over to Cedar Rapids while the house sold first. So I had to move for the welfare of the group. And I don't understand marriage. Hell, I've been through enough of them. I have no idea about marriage. I have no idea, but I understand the group. I understand the group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And my time's short, and so I'm going to bring it to an end. I want to thank you again for coming. Your presence means something to me. And it has been an experience, in one in which I will learn. And I have to run to the airport right away. So I want to tell you now that I love you all. And keep on keeping on. You know, we know it just can get better, you know. And thanks a lot for letting me share.